always, with me are Dixie Cochran.
Hello.
And Matthew Dawkins.
Hello.
And today is an emergency episode. Yay!
Woo, 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 woo. SOS! Oh gosh, help us!
We need the Silent Hill alarm. You know, this is where everything in Onyx Path is turning decidedly brown. And rusty, obviously, you know, and the metal is flaking off the walls, that sort of thing. That's where I was going with this.
So the Dystopia Rising art direction is going on right now, so that's appropriate. But our plans for this week kind of didn't work out the way we'd hoped. Lots of conventions going on, so we're kind of putting something together last minute, but luckily this week we're going to have a lot of cool content for you, because to start off with, I did manage to record my panel at Save Against Fear. And it went, it was like an hour and a half long panel. I'm going to cut it down a little bit for time here, but I mean, it's still going to be like an hour and 25 minutes. And it was me and Rich Thomas were on the panel at the same time, so you get more of patented Eddie and Rich banter. Also, we had Barrick Blackburn, who was one of the designers on RetroStar, as well as a regular contestant for Game Chef. Doug Lewandowski, who worked on 7 Minutes in Hell and Kids on Bikes. And Joseph Thompson, always commonly known as Bear, who worked and was the lead director for Project Biomodius. So lots of cool up-and-coming designers, as well as people who are moving into this space. Lots of great questions from the audience. The usual caveats, just like with Gen Con episodes, it's sometimes hard to hear the questions from the crowd. And also the table, I found out after we were done, the table was slightly unstable, so there's occasionally a bumping sound you'll hear as people would touch the table and it moved.
That was actually one of the funniest parts of our freelancer panel that Megan Fitzgerald was on, is that she kept like punching the table to emphasize things.
Yes.
And I was kind of going like, no, don't do that, we're recording. But, yeah. You know, I didn't want to say that while she was being very passionate about her answer. So
right.
I'm like, well, we'll just have to deal with this sound. Sorry. You take what we give you, audience. You
right.
Take it and you like it.
Whoa, hey.
I just turned into Matthew Dawkins for a minute.
What? What? Well.
I mean... You're gonna be on the queue soon. I mean, we're gonna have to let you go.
I don't know how to compute this information. But you know, it's probably true.
So while we sort out what we're gonna do with Matthew in future, we'll just go right on to the panel.
What brings you here? So that could be your work that you're working on right now. You're excited about past work they may have heard of or may not know that you've done. Current interests. That sort of thing. So we'll start that way.
I'm here because Jack asked me to come. He likes my game RetroStar that came out through Spectrum Games, which is a game of 1970s sci-fi television shows and other stuff. So
to be clear, I don't think "like" is a strong enough word for Jack's emotions.
I describe Jack as a guy who talks in all exclamation points.
There you go.
I'm Doug Lewandowski. I'm here because Jack was gracious enough to invite me, and I don't know if I told you this, I planned on saying no, and then I looked into the con and was like, no, I have to go to that. That's amazing. So I do. So I just think the whole premise of this con is so cool. So I've worked on Kids on Bikes, which I co-designed as my first big published RPG. I did another RPG called 7 Minutes in Hell for Ninth Level Games. It was part of their Tragedies of Middle School anthology. And then a couple card or board games that are currently out of print, so.
That's always awkward.
Yeah, not worth mentioning at this point.
Right.
Collector's items.
Yeah. There you go.
Imagine working on mobile games that go out that you can't install anymore
because
the servers are shut down.
Yeah,
that's fun.
My iPad 1 can still run it, right?
Fire up the old Apple II. No. My name's Eddie Webb. I'm here because Jack forced me to against my will. So please send help. But no. main game I've worked on recently is Pugmire, and its companion game, Monarchy Zamao, which will be shipping soon. But also, previous to that, I've worked on Cartoon Action Hour with Spectrum Games that does Retro Star. I've worked on Vampire the Masquerade. I've done freelance work for 125 other books. So, I mean, I have a long list, but mainly for here, I've heard so many good anecdotes, both from the attendees of this convention and elsewhere, about Pugmire in therapeutic sessions, in ad hoc home situations. So I was excited to meet people and to learn more on how I can improve my own craft as a designer based on those anecdotes.
First thing you said to me was, boy, they really do love Pugmire.
No, seriously,
here.
Yeah. Rich was like, Rich,
you gotta come to this con. It's great.
Yeah, Rich was like, no, they really like Pugmire here. I was like, okay, cool, yeah, I'll show up. And say, like, no, you guys really like Pugmire. I was like, okay, I get it now.
Yeah. I'm Rich Thomas, the founder of Onyx Path Publishing and longtime troublemaker at White Wolf. And,
legit, true.
I've come to this convention now 8 years. Is that about it? Yeah. And first one, I just thought it was cool that there was a local convention. I was just starting up Onyx Path, and I think it'd be really nice thing to see what's going on. It's about an hour drive from where I am.
Wait, stop. Onyx Path's been around for 6 years.
I was thinking about it.
8 years ago.
Yeah.
Are you a time traveler?
No, I think these things through. I knew it was coming. We were founded in 2012.
And that is why you're the elder vampire and you're being here.
He's a now traveler.
Right.
So, go to the thing, and in the course of it, got to talk to Jack a little bit, and he started to explain why they were having the convention. It was at Six Feet Under, I think, right? And it just clicked with a lot of the things that I've been hearing from anecdotally from people, because we were doing the Vampire 20th Anniversary Edition conventions and stuff, so a lot of people had stories about how this role-playing had changed their lives.
Right.
A lot of it was in terms of getting over things from their past and or being able to step up. The classic everything I learned about courage I learned from playing D&D sort of thing.
Yep.
And the more I talked to Jack, the more it made a lot of sense, and what they were trying to do with taking role-playing and using it as a therapeutic tool kind of just meshed with a lot of my thinking on how our little silly hobby is actually much more of an art form, much more of a thing that changes people when you do it. So I've been around it on board, and I am actually on the board of Bodana now. And so, of course, I had to come to the con.
You're
going to
have to now.
Right, yeah. Yeah. It just looks awkward.
Yeah, I mean, they're like, look. You cannot show up, but then maybe we won't remind you when the board meeting is.
So my name is Joseph Thompson. Most people just call me Bear. I am from England originally. I now live in California. And I am the creative director of a company called Tatum Systems. We make a game called Project Biomodus. And I initially got turned on to Save Against Fear when, for the longest time I've always thought, you know, why don't people use tabletop games to provide therapy for anybody, really, you know, regardless of age. Tabletop games are great. And in researching that, I came across the Bodana Group's website, and I just happened to send an email saying, love what you guys do, here's what my story, how can I support? And Jack got back to me, told me about the convention, and I came, 2 months after that? And that was last year, and last year was my first convention, and I'm just absolutely astounded by the feeling of warmth and family that comes to this place. So this has become a yearly thing for me now. But in comparison to you guys, I feel woefully underqualified to be here. So thank you for dragging my British ass out here. And see me. But
tally ho.
Tally ho indeed. Yeah, great to see you guys.
Awesome. Thank you very much. For anybody who needs to watch their watch or clock, I just want to let you know my goal for this panel is for it to end by 4 at the latest, depending on how things are going. And if you need to get up and go elsewhere, that's totally fine. Don't worry about that.
If you come late, that's totally fine.
We'll judge you quietly.
Yeah. Yeah.
We'll know.
Eddie will take it personally, but the rest of us are fine. So, all right, as we're getting started, I have a question for all of you designers and in any order you want to take it, whatever. And my question as you begin is, how do you begin? So you're at step zero on a game, and you're about to start designing something. What is your process? What is your approach? Because I imagine it'll be different for each of you, but we'll see.
Drinking.
Yeah, okay, drinking, right?
Yes.
Not you. The rest of you.
Stay hydrated is very important.
Yeah,
yeah, that should be meant.
Oh, water. You can drink that. Yeah. You can drink that too. Yeah.
Or decaffeinated coffee.
Yeah, right. Decaf coffee. This is downhill. No.
Or Chaz's gin.
How much you guys have?
It's first come, first serve.
Okay. Yep. For me, it depends on the game to a certain extent. Some games start from a mechanical perspective. Like, here's a cool mechanical interaction or a cool economy I want to explore, and what story does that cycle tell? Other times, like with Pugmire, it was, I have just a random, bizarre idea that connects with another idea that's been in my head for 10 years. And I think for me, a lot of it is the initial starting of design is additive. Like, here's a piece, but that's not quite enough for a whole game. Here's another piece, that's not quite enough for a whole game. Oh, if I put these two together, then this third element, I start to kind of lumber them together and say, okay, actually, I'm seeing something interesting here. And then the actual design process is then subtracting back down to the core of what the actual design is. So, I mean, it does depend on the concept. But if I have to say, okay, I need to make a game now, which as a professional, sometimes that's on my plate. It's okay, Rich is like, I need you to make this game for this time, for Onyx Path. I will start from what is the game trying to do, and how do the mechanics tell that story, and then start from there. So it usually starts with mechanics on pretty early on.
Cool. I'll just jump in because mine's pretty similar. Mm-hmm. It really depends. So a game that I have coming out shortly began when I said, oh, wouldn't it be cool if when you traded with somebody, then you got to draw a card, and then just said,
oh, yeah.
And then just kind of built from there. Or something like Kids on Bikes was very much a, John and I sat down and said, we want to do something that sort of pays homage to D&D and classic role-playing games that's going to be all about nostalgia on that front, mm-hmm. and then you're going to build this nostalgic world, and so that's going to be there too. But we don't want to do the overcomplication of, you know, first or second ed D&D with Thaco and everything, even though that was in the initial draft. Shame on me.
yeah, nothing wrong with that.
And then, and so playing around with those ideas, and then some of it is throwing mud and seeing what sticks.
Mm-hmm. As a quick digression, I find it fascinating. Both Kids and Bison Pugmire, I didn't notice them just now, but we both start from the position of nostalgia and D&D. Mm. And they're two completely different games. Mm-hmm. So that's another thing is, like, as you're working on stuff, if you say, oh, someone else made this game, they have the same idea, that's how you implement it is a huge difference. But you mentioned nostalgia and D&D. That's how I started with Pugmire. So it's interesting that they're very different games, but they start from the same core.
Yeah. And I generally try to keep some sort of design philosophy in mind. So with Kids on Bikes, it was, we want this to be simple and easy, and very much in the initial 6 months that we were working on it, we were focused on the concept of, like, duality, so that for everything good that happens, there's something bad that happens, mm-hmm. and everything bad, there's something good. So that's where the idea of, like, adversity tokens for failed rolls came from, that you can now bump something using that. So, yeah.
Anyone else?
I do Game Chef, which I've done for several years. I don't know if anyone knows that or knows that. It's a yearly competition, happens usually in the summer. They give you a theme and ingredients, and you have to use the theme, you have to use at least two of the ingredients. And I always look forward to that because what it does is it forces me to put everything else aside and sort of focus on this one thing. And you have, like, 10 days to, like, design a game, write it, design it, play test it, do whatever you have to do and submit it. And I really love that, because what that does is that forces me to do things I never would have thought of, because mm-hmm. I sort of sit there and I have, like, okay, what am I going to do with this? You know, it's like someone gives you, like, okay, here's black paint and, you know, this, and what are you going to do? And you're like, okay. So that's part of it. Then the other thing is, like, so I always, I try and end up with something for that, but then I have tons of ideas that are sort of percolating and various ideas of completion that all have to do with, like, oh, what do I want to, like, it'd be cool if there was a game that did this, or it'd be cool if there was a game that did this, or I want a game that does this, or I'll have an idea for a mechanic. So this game, Strong Island, was an idea for a mechanic I had, and it took me a long time to figure out how to do it, and I kept coming back to it and thinking about it and pounding my head. And a lot of them are just, I'll have, you know, one thing that's half a page of notes for like, here's what would be cool. Like, it would be cool if this was a thing. And then sometimes I just have inspiration that I'll be like, oh, I need to make a game like this. And so I'll work on something like that. But it's very similar process, but it's also, most of mine are like, oh, what if we had something that did this? I'll watch a TV show or see a movie and it'll evoke a feeling. And I'll be like, what's that feeling? And how could I get that feeling in a game?
Mm-hmm. A lot of that too, definitely.
Yeah.
I come at it from a very, very different perspective because I don't consider myself a game designer. I don't function that way. As a publisher, I wait for pitches. So how do you get started with a game? I wait until someone tells me they have a game.
And then he tells me to design it.
Yeah. As creative director, I'm a kibitzer on the game design. Right? So I'm poking at little things. Mostly, and I think that is really, really important, is what does it feel like?
Yeah.
And a lot of times we can intellectualize, and especially people, game designers are really good with systems, can work out systems that function really elegantly and beautifully. But the question, for players, that you always have to ask is, what does it feel like to them? What's the experience they're going to get out of it, and how are they going to feel as they're doing it? Because if they feel awful about it, I mean, even like in a, you know, you could have a terrible, nasty, like vampire, let's say, sort of scenario, and it's just awful things are happening, but you feel good when you come out of it for some reason. Mm-hmm. If you feel completely bad about something, those are the games which people kind of mess around with and then don't go back to.
Right.
You want to go back to the thing that feels good.
There has to be a catharsis.
Yeah. So that's what I really look for, is the moment in a pitch where I go, ah, I know how people are going to feel about that. In Eddie's pitch for Pugmire, it wasn't until I got to the Code of Man, mm-hmm, where there was, he said straight up, he said, like, there's, in dog society, there are no evil dogs. They're bad dogs.
Right.
And good dogs.
Right.
They're but there evil aren't dogs. Evil dogs. And I went, look at that. That's gonna hit people. Like, if all the thinking on this game goes along that same level of making it so tight to what a dog could be like into the creative site, this is gonna be great.
And actually, to talk about design a little bit, when I first sent the pitch to Rich Pugmire, it was called The Fall of Pugmire, and it was very elegiac. I mean, it was the idea that dog society has fallen and they're trying to draw themselves up from the remains, and Rich was like, this is way too downbeat. And we'd have a lot of talk about how to pitch that appropriately, because I felt there needed to be some depth there. And Rich pointed out correctly, as he goes, you feel bad for playing this game. And so we talked a lot about the Code of Man. So it was an interesting counterpoint to have that perspective of, okay, here's what Rich wanted from publisher wanted to draw out of it. So sometimes a good part of early design is to bounce it off of somebody else who maybe doesn't completely agree with you, to help to focus it better. So, okay, no, this is really what I want out of the game.
Which we do all the time, really.
We do a lot. We disagree a lot. Jovially, but we do disagree.
Yeah, usually on names for things.
Oh, my God. There's one more book with the word blood dark in it. I'm going to scream.
Fire. People like fire. I have a game pitch called Dark Blood Fire. Unfortunately, I just got what fire blood.
But there's no bad blood.
There's no bad blood.
Oh. Dark blood, darkness.
My blood is diseased.
I'm inflamed with anger right now.
Lightning is a little secondary fire thing.
All right, Bear. What is your process like?
So mine is a combination of inspiration and annoyance. So when I'm looking at a system, generally having exposure, if you want to go into design, and this is true for the video game side as well, when you start as a designer, you look at a lot of your source material. So video game people will pick other video games and play through and see what they like and what they don't. And one of the main basic premises for me as a designer is to remove the parts I don't like and put in the parts I do.
Mm-hmm.
And that also sometimes, like, before I started designing games, I would do things like, using an example, I converted the Guyver into the World of Dogs.
Wow.
Yeah. So like, and that was like one of my first like fan mods of a system.
Do you still have it?
I did MacGyver into the World of Dogs.
So that would be even better.
And like five nods and everything.
Like, oh my God. The singularity has happened. But for me, it's not any funny that inspiration that you like. Like, for me, I'm inspired a lot by biopunk and cyberpunk and anything that transhumanism, especially.
Mm-hmm.
Transhumanism I absolutely love. But the annoyance part comes out of system mechanics that I don't like, and how would I do them better? And there is, for every idea that's out there is always going to be something that is going to annoy me. Whether it be I'm rolling too many dice, or I don't like the fact that my actions are limited to, you know, standard swift movement, and then everybody else has to take a turn at the table for 20 minutes, and if I'm rolling poorly, that was one of my big bugbears. Yeah. So, and really, your design doesn't have to be complete immediately. You don't have to put something on paper and be like, this is it, this is the final thing. It's always changing. So, for Project Biomodus, I started it years and years ago, and it was a combination of inspiration from a video game called Warframe, and how would I do a dichotomy of two character parts coming together where one is constant and one is separate, and then you could change out one part and that makes an entirely different character while keeping a core value, and that's what the original design was. And it was like three sheets of paper that sat in a manila folder on my bookshelf for like 2 years, and then I found my time to get a piece of this design, make my own world, and then as that world grew, I would make more systems that would influence or would be influenced by that world, and then you build some more world around it and you make some design. So it's a constant back and forth between like systematic design and then thematical design, for me, at least, anyway.
You allow it to evolve.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the buzzword in the industry is iterative, but yes, same thing. Basically, just constantly changing and changing and changing until you get sick of looking at it, or you feel like it's in a good place.
Mm-hmm. Or it's time to go get a press.
Or it's time to go to press, yeah.
And those iterations don't have to be good. Like that, that was super liberating for me when I was first designing. It was whatever we put on the table has to be something we're sure is better than the last thing. And that's super not the way to do it.
Oh my God, no. But you're right, because your instinct is, oh, it has to be an improvement. And you realize sometimes, you have to go on blind alleys to understand better what you're trying to do.
Right.
So a related question that came from our group here, for again, any of you to jump in and talk about, how do you know or decide whether to reinvent the wheel or whether to reskin something that already exists?
Do you hate it?
Yeah, seriously.
Say more.
Do you hate the wheel, and is it time to put some more spokes on it, or make it a different shape? Do you want to turn it into a tank tread? You know, there's all sorts of
hover.
Exactly. Like, don't be afraid to think outside the box. That idea might seem completely nutso when you first start, but as it builds and you get different iterations of it, then maybe you're onto something new. Like, designing is just as much luck and inventiveness as it is finding something that people will like. Don't ever be afraid to try something new, for me.
Well, it's that whole thing, when opportunity knocks, you have to be ready for it, and that's the way a lucky design is.
Right.
If you're open to it, if you're doing an iterative process where that allows that to come into it, that you'll have a better chance of finding that lucky thing. Than if it's, you're really locked in on, I know exactly what this thing has to be.
Right.
Okay, then that's what the thing will happen. You'll miss that cool thing that just fluttered by.
One of the best pieces of advice I got was take your ego out of it. And it's like, if you've got someone in your community, like I've got a few people on my Discord server that a lot of other people have asked me to ban, but I won't, because when they come to me, even though they don't often portray it in a very civil way, they're absolutely right. And if I can't justify a design decision to those people and explain it fully without making myself feel like I'm bending my own rules, then I need to relook at that.
Right.
Like, ego out here, for sure.
Yep. Another thing to think about if you're building from an existing system or mechanics, I generally use the shortcut tech. But you know, if you're building from something like a Savage Worlds or OGL or whatever, is that there's a certain amount of expectations and beliefs and concepts that come with that. Even if your game worked equally well in, say, Savage Worlds and Fates, those are two very distinct communities, and they're coming from very distinct perspectives. So if you want to lean into that, then there's value to that, but understand that that's coming with it. That's one of the reasons why, for example, Pugmire is based on the D&D engine. I could have gone a number of directions, including a proprietary story path system that Onyx Path has, but D&D has a certain amount of emotional weight that comes with it. That was important because, again, my game, my concept was nostalgia. I wanted to have nostalgic feeling because nostalgia was important to why the dogs do what they do. So the system choice was very much an aesthetic choice to a certain degree, as well as, you know, a mechanical shorthand. So these kinds of things you also need to think about. There are times if you want to have a very well-crafted, specific experience, though, you may want to start from scratch, or at least inspired by other things, but generally building your own direction. But otherwise, yeah, I mean, if you come in with a prepackaged system, like, you maybe hate it, I want to change certain things to get it across, I mean, I want people to feel a certain thing because they're engaging with this relatively known mechanical interaction.
Well, D&D 5th is a relatively simple system considering other versions of D&D that have been out there, and it's something that a lot of people know, and yet you still simplified it.
Yeah, I mean, more simple.
Because that was really what we were doing. We wanted to say this, we want this to be very accessible for people.
Right.
We already were kind of getting the feeling that there would be a lot more younger players,
yep,
maybe even people who hadn't played before. We didn't expect the sheer number of people who said, this is going to be the first game my significant other has ever played.
A lot of that.
Tons of that, especially during the Kickstarter. But the fact that we had actually gone into it with the idea that we're going to make this thing as easy to get you into the fun parts
right,
as fast as possible.
Because the way I pitched to Rich was specifically is I wanted D&D not as it exists, but D&D as we remember it. And so that's why it had to be as simple as possible, because everyone remembers when they played a long time ago, you know, if you're ancient like me, it's like, I remember being super easy, and you go back to the books and say, wow, how did I live with this? What? Why did I live with Thaco for so long? but in your mind, it was always elegant and easy and fluid, and that's what I was trying to design for, was that what that memory of the game was, rather than what actually existed.
And then, for me, the question of when you're borrowing something versus when you're stealing something is sort of comes back to the idea of nostalgia, mm-hmm, or homage and how explicit you are about it.
Yep.
So, you know, some of the safety procedures we use in Kids on Bikes are taken directly from other people, but they're credited in the rule book, and we reached out to them and said, hey, can we use the X card? Can we use
the X card? Oh, I'd love to say the X card. Yeah.
Or, you know, for some of the mechanics, for the next game John and I are working on, we borrowed something from an existing game, adapted it, but in the rules, we're still going to be saying, you know, anyone who's experienced with this will notice that it's very similar to, we've adapted it and we appreciate what they've done. In part because the role-playing design community is very open to that.
It's been part of it since the beginning.
Yeah, with Powered by the Apocalypse saying, just use it, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And even the idea is that there are things within other things that you're playing, you think they work really great, and then you apply them in your head to your thing.
Right.
You know, why should I fake this and jury rig it when I could just take from this, adapt it into my thing, just like I just did in my head?
Right.
And that's been going on since the beginning.
70s, yeah.
I mean, you know, since D&D first came out.
Mm-hmm. And show of hands, who has played a homebrew setting for D&D?
Tell you.
Right? That's kind of, well, that's basically your intro to game design right there.
Right.
It's the first modding.
So,
right.
So pause real quick. What is the X card?
So the X card is...
somebody doesn't know.
Sure. X card is a safety mechanism you can use during really any game. Where there's a card in the middle that has a big X on it, and anytime somebody is uncomfortable with what's happening at the table, they just reach out, tap it, you rewind the story, whoever's currently has narrative control rewinds to where they think the person will be comfortable again, and just goes in a different direction. There's no discussion, there's no, oh, well, let's talk about why you don't want to talk about spiders. It's just...
And I talk about spiders, I'm thinking about spiders. Right. Now I'm thinking
that. That's what I was trying to avoid.
And it avoids the verbal part of somebody having to say, hey, everybody, I'm really uncomfortable with this. But it builds it in a very explicit way so that everyone knows it's really okay for you to do this. So.
My friend has a button that you push and it says, try that another way.
Mm. Oh, wow.
That's pretty good.
That one that's
a little rigged up thing?
Yeah, yeah. It's like the easy button from Staples or whatever.
Oh, right.
Redid it, so it said something different.
Nice.
Well, and the thing about the X card, and I said this at the start of my game that I ran today, certain games bring with them certain expectations. Like, you're playing D&D, there's going to be killing. You're playing Monster Hearts, people are going to have sex. Like, so, you know, if you get squigged out by sex, that's not the game for
right,
you.
Right.
But you also need to understand that there are things that, like, you know, oh, and I stab a dog. So I'm like, no, no, no violence to pets. Like, you won't know. And I tell the story, right. And it's true. Someone in my game group, I run a superheroes game, and I wanted to do, like, an April Fool's, like, Joker thing. And they were like, are you going to do an April Fool's thing? I was like, maybe. And they were like, don't. And I was like,
we
okay.
Hate surprises.
No, a close friend of theirs committed suicide on April 1st. So the day
you don't
is like,
commemorate it.
Yeah.
They're just like, and so that was off the table.
Yep.
Like that. And and you never know what someone's thing is going to be. So I when I run games at conventions especially, I say, we're definitely going to cover this ground.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's a content warning.
Like, this is, you know, this is what we're going to cover. But then if other stuff comes up, let me know and we'll move past it. But I think that that's important. But the X card is great, but you also need to do understand that, like, you know, if we're, you know, going down a thing, you know, like, that's D&D, we're going to kill some things, you know.
Well,
like
that's why it has to be a social contract.
Yeah,
I mean,
absolutely.
Everybody agrees the X card is part of what you're doing. Okay, cool.
Yeah. And that's what Lines and Veils does really nicely.
Yeah.
Lines and Veils is, at the beginning of the game, before you start playing, you discuss where the lines we're not going to cross in the narrative at all, right? We're not going to have spiders at all in the game, any reference to spiders, anything like that. And then a veil is something we're just going to drop a veil over it. So,
fade to black.
Fade to black.
Right. Violence against animals.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Essentially,
exactly.
Make sure you have that as a mechanic.
Yeah.
We're already talking about meta mechanics.
Yeah.
All right. So, are there any, I want to pause real quick. Anyone has a question? Yes. Bring in your mind.
Go for it.
So, whenever, like, through the process of making the game, a lot of games have a theme that go along with the mechanics of it. How do you make those two merge and really make them work well together instead of it just being a mechanic that has a theme slapped onto it or a theme that has mechanics slapped onto it?
Is this for anybody or do you have someone in particular in mind?
All right,
anybody, take it.
That's my whole goal with games. Is I'm all about, like, stupid, ridiculous themes, which means my games are real small. But they do a thing. And my whole goal is to do that thing.
Really, really.
And whatever that thing is, I want to do that thing. So my sci-fi game is all about, like, the ridiculous stuff that happens in 70s sci-fi. So I put a lot of time and effort to do this one thing, and everything sort of came out of that. And so, as opposed to, you know, something where you have, you know, numerous sort of subsets of mechanics, you're, like, my whole focus, you know, not all the time, but when I do my own thing, is like this one thing. Like, what is it I want the experience to be, and how can everything move towards that experience?
Right, that sort of unity of effect thing. So, for me, if I'm designing something thematically first, my question is always, or once I have a theme that I like, the question is, what will make this feel like this? So one of my games was about treating monsters medically from Gothic literature. And so the question was, okay, well, what would a doctor do in this situation, right? And then in Kids on Bikes, it was, what will feel like D&D but be easy D&D?
Right.
And what will be sort of duality and work with the theme of no one is entirely good or entirely bad? And just making choices around that, where the mechanical stuff then comes back, that if you keep one or two ideas in mind that are the sort of core idea that you're going for, I think mechanical questions become pretty easy to answer. Easy is a strong word.
If they're not easy to answer, you iterate.
Right.
Get people playing it. If you get people playing it and they're responding to it, like, that thing that we did, that was so much, like, the you know, that was perfect for what we were doing, then you know you're going down the right path. If people are, like, kind of, man, I really hated the fact that this is a game of burdens and we had to carry those big rocks, you know, like, that was too much, then you can kind of get a feel for, you know, are you getting through to people what you were trying to get through? And then you just keep going back and forth on it.
Right. One of the things that I do a lot is I do consulting for companies with existing IPs. So a lot of times I have to figure out from them what they think that core theme experience is. And it depends. I've worked on, as an example, I worked on the WWE role-playing game, and a wrestling game can go a lot of different directions depending on what they think the core theme is. So through all that, I've ended up, what you mentioned, the design philosophy, I think it's the same thing. It's like, you know, one sentence statement of, this is a game that's going to do this thing. And as you make design decisions, if anything gets in the way of that one sentence statement, get rid of it. And sometimes you'll find some surprising places to cut. Like when we're doing a Pugmire, I was getting in the weeds a bit on D&D because, like, you know, there's a lot of different ways you can take and simplify that. And I realized one of the big problems I was having is that when I was playtesting it, people were still killing a lot and taking treasure. And I realized, what if I just take away all the incentives for treasure and all the incentives for killing? I got rid of experience points and I got rid of currency completely. And that took a lot of the burden off the game to do those things, because now there's no mechanical benefit for either of those activities.
It's about the story.
Right, yeah, it's about the story. But that was something that I didn't think of at the time. But as I was playtesting it and trying to figure out how to solve the problem, I went back to that core statement, and I realized that looting and pillaging were not in that core statement. So I was like, can I just cut this? And usually the answer is yes. It's weird because it's designed to feel like it should be an additive process, like to add more rules to fix things. A lot of times taking away is better, because it distills down to that core theme. You know, is this going to make inflect a 70 sci-fi show? Is this going to be D&D as kids play it? If you're not hitting those points, it's probably unnecessary, and you'll be surprised what you can cut.
Adaptability is very key. I think when painters start painting pictures, they usually start with very vague shapes, and then they kind of build detail on top of that. And if you've got one of the biggest like self wounds, I think you knew is have something so set in your mind that you're not willing to make adjustments to it. So when you're starting the design process, you know it's good to just throw a bunch of ideas down and see if they work. Like these guys have said, have people try it out, see if it works for them. It might, how it appears in your head on paper is not necessarily how it will appear or how it will play for a player. There might be a mechanic that just to you seems elementary, but to them seems a little convoluted or too weighty. And you know, just have the ability to take a step back and look at it as well. Do I need to put detail on this background tree, or should I be focusing more on the sort of central part of the picture? Just give yourself room to maneuver, and don't, especially with playtesting, don't be afraid to throw something that you think might not work, you know, into it. If you think thematically it will work better, and then your players will tell you if it works. They are usually very vocal about whether something works or not. They will let you know.
If they're polite, you can watch their faces. Watch for the phones to come out.
Right.
Don't ever be afraid of criticism from players. It may sound harsh sometimes, and sometimes it may cut you to the core. But ultimately, you can still come away with something. You need to remember that it's your product that they're reviewing, not necessarily you.
As a quick caveat to that, though, just because someone criticizes you doesn't mean you always have to take out what they're saying. Mm-hmm. But if you can answer the criticism, that's still valid.
Yeah.
Being able to say, no, it's this way and here's why, mm-hmm. that's still a valid... The criticism is still valid because you're able to justify that mechanic's existence or why it's designed the way it is.
Yeah, in that case, you're honing your
right.
creation of this thing.
Right. As long as that response is not... Well, because I said so. That's not good. People say, yeah. No, it's because it's evoking this particular theme and it causes this kind of thing and it ties it to the mechanical cycle in this way. That's all valid. But someone says, I don't like this, and you go, okay, why is that? Oh, I see, because you're actually talking about this piece and maybe this could be adjusted.
And, you know, try to get your head around the emotional reason for why they're saying, maybe they're really aggressive with you because they came to this thing expecting it to be one way and it plays a totally different way, and they're disappointed because they had built up expectations. So now they're pissier than they normally would be.
Oh yeah,
and that can tell you a lot about what's happening with your game, because now you are affecting people. They must like something about it, or they wouldn't be so pissy, right? But this thing is maybe you talk. Maybe the whole first chapter talked about one thing, and then by the time they actually play it, it's totally not that. Well, that's a reason to get upset. You know,
theme and the aesthetic of your game. Are one of those things that you can have a bit more pushback on. Like, so for instance, in my game, most of the water in the world is burnt away. It's like very, and there's no scientific reason why that should happen.
Right.
Like, science will tell us that, in a post-apocalyptic situation, the water levels will actually lower because, you know, there's less man-made pollution. It's not gonna be like Mad Max, but I want my game to be like Mad Max, where everything's a bloody desert, so everything's gonna be a bloody desert. Like, I'm gonna soft science that.
You could have said it in Australia.
Like, bloody desert.
No one's gonna tell me how to do my game, mate.
It's all the desert.
British
beer.
Where did the shrimp on the Barbie come from when you're in the desert?
Just the mechanical dingoes everywhere.
Going for the babies.
Going for the babies.
Watch out, Sheila.
So,
wow.
If that is your theme, there is no reason. If you are making a soft science game, then there is no reason for you to have hard science reasons for something being there. That's something that you can definitely push back on.
Yeah.
If you are saying that a core mechanic of my game is doing this, and the criticism is that something mechanically doesn't work or is too burdensome on the player, that is something that you should pay more attention to.
Absolutely.
Because you're impacting the player's experience. Like, you're never going to be able to make an aesthetic situation that pleases everyone.
Right.
Like, that's a design choice that you have to make as a designer, and some people are going to like it and some people aren't. But when it comes to player enjoyability, like, that is something that is generally more shared across the board than it is, say, an aesthetic taste towards post-apocalyptic or fantasy or whatever else you can come up with. Aesthetics, definitely, you've got much more ground to push back on.
And if it's a good idea and you take it out of this game, put it in the next one.
Right, right.
Build a whole game around just that thing.
Yeah.
And I mean, there's always another game. It's one of the things when people first start creating things is they think that they're going to do this one thing. This is it. Everything's been coming to this moment. And actually, it's a whole series of them, and you're going to make a whole lot more if you're really into this.
Yeah.
And one of the things about taking feedback that I would recommend is, when people give you feedback, write everything they say down. Even if, as you're writing it, you go, this is the dumbest thing I've ever heard.
Right.
Like, what if there were, like, more, you know, like, naked women in this game? I would like it better than, like, women in game. And then arrow no, right?
Well, nope. Unless it is a nudity game, in which case.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Excellent point. It was all naked men. My bad.
Sure.
I wasn't thinking.
And so, but the flip side to that is, I then try to look that feedback over later when I have more time to process it, and start from the assumption that the feedback is correct, even if I wrote no next to it the first time, and think about, okay, under what circumstances would this feedback be right? That helps to take me out of the, because I'm the designer, that's why kind of mentality that I was very guilty of when I had my first and one and only game that was going to be the greatest thing ever that's now out of print. And with that, I was very dogmatic. It's going to be this way, which is bad when you have a co-designer. really thinking that the feedback might be correct, I think, helps to get you out of that sort of, it's going to go this way and it's going to be that way kind of mindset.
At least under what circumstances is it correct?
Right.
So we've had excellent discussion. A lot of it has been theoretical, or in terms of process. I'd like to go more concrete for a moment. So I'd like, and this is for each of you, in whatever order you choose, I would like for you to describe a mechanic that you really like. It could be from your game, from any game you've played, like a discrete mechanic that you just, it's so meaty. And describe, like, what it is and then what you like about it.
You're gonna say roll defense, right?
And then go, yeah.
So, longtime D&D player. And with 5th edition, I love now I forget what it's called, you know, the thing.
The thing with the stuff in the dice?
I love that.
That narrowed it down.
The advantage and disadvantage, thanks.
Because I love the same.
No one helped me.
It's because you're babbling.
No.
They stole that.
At my age, you're lucky I'm able to speak without just spitting cuts. And I'll be sitting right next to you when I do it.
Right to the hearing.
Right. Yeah. And so advantage and disadvantage. So
they stole that from Cartoon Action Hour.
Kinda, yeah.
It was a way to simplify a lot of number crunching and a lot of stuff that was part of how D&D kind of evolved. When we started playing back when Greyhawk came out,
big Greyhawk poster over there.
It was a lot more fluid and a lot less of looking up charts for every single thing. So as it evolved and grew, and people put more and more boundaries and numbers to it, this was a really great way to come back to a very intuitive way to proceed with this thing. Oh, this gives me advantage. We roll two dice. I get to pick the one I like. Boom. That is a very, very, very simple and very it's not an aesthetic, it's a intuitive way to approach that problem. And I really, really liked it because it really showed they were thinking kind of outside the box, but back into the box. So that's my favorite. I'm sorry.
Who's next?
I'm going to go last.
Damn it, oh, my choice.
So I really like the Powered by Apocalypse way of doing character generation as a team. I
playbooks?
Love it. Yeah. Well, not only that, it's less about the playbooks, it's the questions that you ask of the team.
Oh, right.
So, like, you know, you've got one person who's like, I was in a bad situation and blank helped me out of it. And then you can unpack that and be like, what was the situation? How do your characters know each other? And so your first game session when you're all doing character creation, you basically establish a history for your team. And you can actually build a world. Like, I've been playing Masks a lot recently.
Mm.
And what started off was just blank templates on these character playbooks suddenly turned into, like, they're a young bunch of supers that are suddenly an esports team for this game called Virtual Vengeance, which stars all of, like, the golden age superheroes that are, like, their protégés and mentors. And they were at the Twitch was sponsoring them for something, and the chief of police died at the first game running, and that's how they came into, like, the spotlight as a team. They fought some bad guy called Aztec, and it's all stuff that the players make up.
All backstory.
It's all backstory in this like couple hour session. Somebody built this whole world from just a few questions that just make them think how they interact and what happened in the world to get them to where they were. It's not just like everybody writes their backstories individually and then the GM has to kind of wangle some way. They build the team and the world around them, and I think that is absolutely phenomenal. Like, having people have influence over each other at some point, having a backstory that you can go back to without having to have, you know, a campaign 6 months long to say, oh, you remember when you got me out of that piece of trouble? Like, you've got something there. It really fleshes out the parts of the character that are not just yours and your stats or your feats or your backgrounds or merits or flaws or anything like that. It's a party build. And the only downfall is that when you've got a new character coming in later on, it's really hard to add them to that.
Yeah.
But initially, like, having that kind of that group unity at the beginning of game session one is just, oh, it's magical. I love it. Absolutely love it.
Who wants to go next?
I like, it's Scream, I think, does it really well. I don't know if anyone knows Scream, Jared Sorensen's. You're in a horror movie game, and you have, like, curiosity is a stat, and you have to roll above your curiosity to not do the thing. So, you hear scratching at the door. Oh, I failed my roll. Yeah, you've got to go open the door. Like, and I like that idea, and I sort of use that for Retro Star with the idea of, like, you lose some control of your character, but that idea of, like, here's these things, and you take some choice away from the characters, but you're moving the story forward, and you're staying true to the genre. Of, like, there are times where you're like, no, I'm going to go off by myself, and everyone's like, don't do it, and you're like, I got it. I failed my role. Yeah, like, I'm just going to go have sex over in the corner over here. That's fine, right? Nothing bad will happen.
I'm
no one's coming with punching you.
You'll meet me there later, right? Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
I'll meet you there. Yeah,
no, I won't. Carl's going to start first time, right?
Yeah.
It'll be fun.
So, and actually, like, Exalted uses that as a sub-mechanic with the virtues.
Yep.
Like, first edition had, like, yes, you can face off against the great dragon, but at the same time, if someone challenges you, you can't turn down that challenge.
Yep.
You have to accept it. And so that idea of, like, I'm really good, but that comes with a drawback. Or I'm really bad, but that comes with a benefit. Like, I can run away. Like, you know. So I do like that, you know, sort of idea. Awesome. You're not last.
Well, I thought you said you had one. Okay,
I have one.
Yeah, go.
Failing forward.
Yeah.
Love it. I think the first time I saw it was with Monster Hearts, and love the way that works. But anything that you can do to make something bad that happens to a person in a game, especially in a role-playing or a storytelling game, feel like, oh my god, I'm actually really glad that thing happened,
right?
Is
that was cool.
Yeah.
Right.
Like, even if it was big.
So you celebrate
the right. It was great that when I tried to impress my friends doing that sweet jump over the gulch on the bike, It was awesome that I fell into the gulch because we found the skeleton.
Right. Right?
And so anything mechanical or as GMs, anything that the GM can do to make those failures feel incredible is good.
Yeah, we actually worked that into the story path system that's powering Scion and the Trinity games and they came from and your
Dystopia Rising
is that the same sort of thing. So, you know, using that good idea that came out of Monster Hearts and has been used in a couple other places too, I think, and saying, you know, how does this work with our system? Right. Yeah, we can make that happen.
Actually, speaking off of stealing good mechanics, one of the ones, cards on the table, my favorite mechanic is probably whatever game I played last that I liked. because my first response was, hey, I just played Satanic Panic yesterday, and it had a really cool ammo mechanic. But instead, what I'll say is the mechanic I tend to go back to a lot, and I ended up actually ripping off to a certain degree for Pugmire, is Karma in Marvel Superheroes 1984 edition. Because on the surface, it doesn't quite work the way it's supposed to, which is that you get these points for doing good deeds, and you spend them as experience points, but you also spend them to get benefits during the game. And there's this kind of weird economy balance of, okay, I don't want to spend it to improve my roles because I need to improve my character, so that piece doesn't quite work as well. But one thing that works at the table I found really well is two pieces. One, that it absolutely incentivizes you to be a hero. One of the rules in the game, this is 80s era comic books, is if you kill someone, you lose all your karma. There's no reason or justification for it, which makes playing Punisher really hard, but it's just they're all gone. So you go out of your way to save people, which is exactly the mechanic the game wants. And the other one is Team Karma, which is that if you're a superhero group, you all contribute to a pool, and then you ask everyone in the game if they want to, if it's okay if I draw from it to save this role, and if no one says no, then you can pull out of it. So again, it becomes Avenger style of, okay, Cap, you know, we really need you to throw that shield so I can hit him with my repulsor rays, so you gotta make that roll, so yeah, take out of the team pool. And so it's a simple shared resource, but it makes everyone feel like they're all as part of the same group, which absolutely became the fortune bowl mechanic for Pugmire. And so it's one of those things that it was intended for a certain direction. I've actually had a chance to talk to some people like Steven Shen who worked on the game, and they said they intended a certain way, but over gameplay it became this much more brilliant mechanic than I think they even initially to a certain degree intended. And it's a really good example of pairing a theme to mechanics.
Awesome. Thank you. So we're going to pause, and any questions have come to mind? Yes, go ahead.
I have a bit of a hypothetical design question. It's a trend I've noticed with more recent pen and paper tabletop gaming where systems are going for much more simplistic, elegant design in order to try to bring in new players, younger players who are intimidated by numbers, mechanics, spreadsheets, crunch, all the different stuff. And I have to ask, if you were to be behind a system with that was trying to get in brand new players who have never touched this hobby at all in any way whatsoever, what's something that you believe should be in that system and should be something that has to be crucial?
I'd make Kids on Bikes.
Well, yeah.
You brought that down to a very small board. Right?
It could be a certain mechanic, it could be a certain idea, just something to, if the person in question, they couldn't rely on the baggage and shorthand of, 30, 40 years of pen and paper RPG, how exactly would you go about that? How would you tackle that challenge?
I would build a fate splat.
Fate splat?
Yeah, just a unique system for fate. If I was tasked to build a game that was primarily for new users incoming into the gaming environment, I would make my own system and attach it to fate. Because fate is fantastic. You roll four dice at any one time and it's a simple plus or minus. And I think for new players, for me at least, I mean, I don't know what the opinion is would be about the board. Role playing for me is about telling a story, and fate is all about learning how to tell a story, how to take aspects of your character, especially the aspect part of it, and then applying that to your character and then using those aspects when they are needed to get bonuses. Like, and mechanics can be learned over a period of time. The basic premise of telling a story and playing a character is something that I think fate highly focuses on, and for me, like, if you can't get that part down, I don't think you're going to get RPGs as a whole. And Fate just really lets people experiment with their characters and develop character. And then mechanically, you can move on to a crunchier system like, say, Cowboy Apocalypse or, you know, D&D. Like, I there's to incrementally increase the crunch, but the first skill that you should use when getting someone new into an RPG is how to play a character and how to tell a story.
I was going to say, you roll a die. If your die roll is greater than, you succeed. If your die roll is less than, you fail. Greater than or equal to, you succeed. And that's it. That's super easy to understand. Not a lot of add this, under this circumstance is this. GM says, okay, grab the d20, I need you to roll 12 or higher. And then that's it, right?
Very basic, you just keep that to basic, just usual feedback loop of describe environment, player narrates, game master explains.
Right, but then in keeping with the idea of this isn't about discrete success or failure, this is about the overall story, helps to make it not feel bad when this role doesn't go the way you want.
I'm going to stick out on a controversial position, and I'm going to say that your supposition is flawed. There's a distinct difference between simple and easy, and I posit to you the Pokemon card game. It is a easy enough game that kids can play it, and frequently do. If you look at the back-end spreadsheets and mechanics, how the game works, it is insanely complicated. But the people playing it, at least to start with, don't recognize the complexity, nor they need to. Because the game is not simple, but it is easy. So I certainly think that you can do both. You can have a simple game that is also easy. That's very easy to do. But you can take a complicated game such as D&D 5th Edition and make it even easier for people to parse, such as Pugmire, or Kids on Bikes, even. So there are ways to do that. You can reduce perceptual complexity while keeping mechanical depth. So just as saying, oh, there's a bunch of numbers is a problem, there are ways to obfuscate the numbers so players don't have to engage with them. There are ways to do things, simple things like putting things on cards so players don't have to constantly memorize them on their character sheet. Making sure the character sheet looks and presents the information in a more effective and attractive way means that those numbers will be, your eye will be drawn to those numbers that they need to see on a regular basis. Organizing your book better so that way the information is getting in small, discrete chunks so you can learn as you play rather than having to have it all up front before you even start play. All of those are ways that you can reframe a complex system into something that's easier for players to play. There's a reason why the old school D&D box sets, basic set, intermediate, advanced, why they sold really well is because they gave you a small chunk of the game, then added more, and added more, and added more. But it was all the same system, and it was a very complicated system. But you started off, you had 64 pages. That's all you had to read.
That's all you need. I mean, people a lot of times go, like, why did White Wolf manage to leap forward in gaming and stuff like that? And I will tell people, and they a lot of times don't believe this, it's because we had little dots on the character sheet.
Dots.
Absolutely.
Because we had... It was for people who didn't who were intimidated by or just got turned off of numbers way back in the day, but they could look at the number of dots they had there. It was a very easy way and a very literal way of seeing it that wasn't numbers based. Yep. And so we had a lot
three by 10 look scary. Three dots.
People wanted to tell stories and not calculate.
Yep. So to actually put that into practice, my first real RPG that I played was Vampire Masquerade, like first edition Vampire Masquerade. And I played that when I was 12.
Like, which is the right age.
Yeah.
Despite what the warning said.
Yeah. Whatever, I didn't get impressed. But I could build a character. I mean, granted, there were some systems that I got wrong, like the whole soaking and thing. Like, our whole group, like, we all got it wrong until we all went back to the book and started reading detailed mechanics. And it's like, oh shit, we've been playing this wrong for like 5 years. But yeah, like having that simplistic format, like me and my little team shitlord buddies were all able to like completely understand.
Proper term is edgelord. Like,
no, we were not.
They were past the edge.
We were edgy, but we were way more shitlords. I still have my black leather trench coat that I bought in Melrose. But yeah, that was just like the premise of taking one dot equals one deep. You roll them and whatever's a six is a success.
We got three dots in this, two dots in that, and that's how many dice I roll.
Yeah. That was a perfect mechanic to understand.
It was a mechanic that appealed to a kind of person who learns things differently, let's say, than a lot of what D&D was doing at the time, and so since so many people were modeling off of D&D, I mean, to be honest, we system-wise,
Storyteller
was pretty much a pull from Shadowrun.
Right.
You know, I mean, the dice pool and all that sort of stuff, but it was the dots that made the difference, in my mind.
Well, also the not the copious weapon charts.
Yeah.
Helps.
Yeah. You can't play with the katana if you don't know.
How do I get my sick motorcycle? That's all I want to know.
So I think, like, if your question is, like, how to get, I mean, are you asking, like, how to get kids involved? Or are you asking, like, how to get someone who...
Let's say, hypothetically, these new players are maybe, like, ages 10, 11 or something, and you want to try to get them into an RPG, and the question was basically, what do you believe should be something that they should take from it?
I think it's a question that has so many what ifs to it, because
right.
if you're talking like as a game, if I'm running the game or to write a game that a parent who doesn't know anything about RPGs,
let's say from a game master perspective, let's say from hypothetically a game master perspective, like. You know, 10, 11, 12 year old
sure.
kid, no real knowledge of RPG, like, you know, what do you bring up? What do you know?
So I saw a friend of mine has young kids and wanted to get them into gaming, and he found, and this is blasphemous and everyone's going to hate me, but he found a stripped down mod of 4E D&D that was designed for kids.
Why is that blasphemous?
Well, because
I like 4E.
I like 4E, but...
I don't think it's blasphemous, but I still hate you.
That's fine. That's okay.
I'm not a fan of what that
is. But what was really nice about it was it was stripped down and it had this sort of board gamey element, as 4E does.
Right.
It took out the grid, but like you just had this little card that said, I want to shoot my arrow. Yeah, you can shoot your arrow. Here's how you shoot your arrow.
Right.
And do this thing. And it was really sort of meant, and I wish I could find it. It was
oh, like it's five or four years ago.
Is that Stowe's?
Huh?
I don't think it was an official thing. It was like
no,
a hack someone made.
You know, Stowe's, James Stowe, has a kid's version of D&D 4th where he's greatly simplified these things mean. So what's the range? The room.
Yeah, right? Yeah. And so it's so stripped down, but kids can be like, I'm a fighter, I'm strong,
right, yeah.
and I have a sword, and I can do this thing, and can I do my special thing? Oh, you can do that, you know, just one, oh, I have shoes when I do that. But it's fun, and it has this real nice tactical element that kids really can engage with, and it tells them what's going to happen, what's not going to happen, and that was great. Like, seeing like that was, like, made me be like, wow, I wish I was a kid so I could play this.
Right,
you know,
totally,
I mean?
Yeah.
Like, that's what you sort of want, like, you know, or that's what I was.
One other thing I thought of while everybody was explaining their stuff was... The more mechanical choices you can remove up front, the better.
Yeah.
So character creation is a series of mechanical choices that a person can't possibly understand without playing the game. Make the characters for them.
Okay.
Right? I ran a game of 5th Ed with some family members who wanted to play, one of whom is pretty seriously dyslexic, and I just made the choices for that person, mechanically speaking. Said, what kind of character do you want to play? And she said, I want to do this, 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 and this. I said, great, that's going to be this character, and then wrote up the sheet and handed it to her.
Yep.
And so the more mechanical choices you can remove up front to open it up for them to make storytelling choices, I think the better.
Kind of off topic, but there was a study done, a psychologist did a study about choice overload. And what's the optimal range? I wish I didn't name a study. But what's the optimal range of choices before a player feels or a person feels like they don't have enough choice or they're overloaded by choice? And it was found that the optimal range is 3 to 7. And so there's a lot of games I've worked on since I've learned that where I've tried to, whenever possible, reduce the choices down to 7 and at least offer 3 whenever possible. Like example, when I do interactive games for mobile or for computer games, I've had to consult with people. It's like, well, you want to have at least 3 choices because 2 choices feels like the player's really not giving choice. Even if the choice, it means nothing, whether you go from 2 to 3, the player still feels like they're getting more choice out of it.
The illusion of choice.
Right, exactly. And illusion of choice is not a bad thing.
As long as it's not too much choice, then it gets too much.
Right, yeah. If you have 2 more than 7, then it becomes, oh my god, I don't know what to decide. So that's another thing to keep. That's just pure good design, period.
Check out Sidekick Quests.
Okay.
Secret of the Sewer Wizard is...
That might be what, like I said, I don't know what it was. Yeah. My friend showed it to me. I was like, that is so cool. And I could totally see how, like, that would be fun for you. And his kids had a great time playing it. So.
Very fascinating answers. Thank you.
Sure.
So I think we're time-wise and room-wise heading toward an end. Before we go, what I would like to ask from each of the five of you, if a person is starting out as a game designer, what is one thing you think they need to know?
Run.
Ideally something like you wish you knew, or a hard-won piece of wisdom that would be very helpful. But what I'm going to say, what is someone starting out, they're interested in being a game designer, what is one thing they need to know or you would like for them to know?
Are you independently wealthy?
Okay. The best way to make a large fortune in the game industry... No, I'm sorry. Small fortune game industry is to start with a large fortune. I screwed up the joke.
Yeah.
So I should not go first. Because obviously I can't talk.
Yeah, I mean, just sort of amalgamating all that, this isn't going to be your job, probably. And if it is, it's going to be after 10, 15 years of it not being your job, maybe.
Yeah.
And so if you're going in with the goal of moving into this professionally within the next couple years, run.
you're gonna make tens of dollars.
Right.
The
right.
Joke I make. Seriously. That's the joke I tell people. Mm-hmm. And these two do a career. People ask me, I'm like, yeah, I meet people who like my games, and I've made tens of dollars.
Yeah,
like,
I make pizza money.
Yeah.
And I started there. I started there too.
Yeah. So and it's fine. Do it because you love it. Do it because you want someone to say, hey, I like your game. Like that was cool. Like I enjoyed playing your game. And do it for that. And if you do make some money, I mean, I get a check from IPR every, you know, mm-hmm. 3 months, and it makes me enough money that I can pay for my next game. Like, you know, and that's it. Like, that's, I mean, you know, I have a job,
success.
Like, you know, and that's, you know, and that to me is good enough. Like, that's where I'm at. I'm good enough with that right now. It's a different time than it was 20 years ago. You know, 20 years ago was a very different time in early games design. And, you know, you have the capability now that there are tools out there that are free. You can do whatever you want to do, and you can upload your PDF to RPG Now, and people can buy it, and you can be like, yay. And you can do it. But do it for the right reasons. Do it not to become rich. You're never going to become famous. Do it because it's what you love to do and it's what you're driven to do. And do it because, you know, you. my great uncle was a writing teacher and would tell people, don't, writers shouldn't study writing. You should study something else, and you write because you're a writer.
Yeah.
And you design games, and if you're fortunate enough, you can make a living at it. But you can still be fortunate not make a living at it. Do it because it's something you love. Do it, I get to, you know, I work at a school, and I'm presenting a panel tomorrow, and so my school says, yes, you can go, and you can take the school vehicle, and we'll pay you for your hotel. So I get to come to conventions, people invite me to conventions, I get to run my games, that to me is great. And I get to play games, because that's what I'm, like, you know, that's what I love more than anything. And do it for that, and do it because you love to do it, and do it, you know, you're never going to get rich. I mean, very few people have gotten rich. There's five, maybe.
Well, I mean, there's a difference between a game designer and a game designer who does it as a professional, as a career.
Yeah.
Right. And you can be a game designer. You can design a lot of games.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you, nowadays, you can get them out there. You can get them to the public, even.
Yep.
You're talking about drive-through and RPG Now and drive-through RPG and stuff like that. Very easy way to get your stuff out amongst amongst the peoples and get feedback and actually have that kind of fun bit of, I didn't just make this and play with my friends and then shuffle it aside when I wanted, but I actually heard from somebody around the world who said, this is amazing. It feels really good. It's a really good reason to create something. Once you say, I'm going to make a career out of this, then you've got to do the same questions and the same answers you got to do in any career.
Yeah.
Am I going to be able to pay my mortgage? What happens if this happens? How am I going to do this?
How many insurance?
Should I be going into tabletop RPGs or should I do that as fun and I do game design in computer games, which gives you have an entirely different track that you would go for in terms of your education, in terms of who you're, which doors you're knocking on to see if you can get a job. And you have different level of expectations. Will they treat me like garbage in this in the computer game industry? Yes, they will. You're a game designer. You're a dime a dozen. You know, it's like the writer in a movie.
Yeah.
It's and a writer in a computer game. it's a very different thing. But you can make games if that's really what you need to do. The other side of it is, you know, get it, do a career that has nothing to do with games, and then do the games that you enjoy as the thing that you do.
It's okay to be a hobbyist. It's perfectly fine to be a hobbyist.
I always say to my kids, I had a friend went to art school with, his dad was an artist, and he was actually kind of, he wasn't really hugely famous, but he was well known. He was a barber. Yeah. He came over from Italy, and he didn't start in a studio and become do fine art. He got his barber business going, and then in the course of the years, he kicked everybody out. It's 4 o'clock. It's a beautiful day. I'm going out in the backyard and I'm painting. And he built up a body of work and would exhibit and things like that. But then the next day, he put on his white smock and got and clipped because he had to. Feed his family, pay the bills, and he was thrilled. I mean, it worked for him. It was a great way for him to keep a balance in his life.
Yeah. All right. Anything else?
I got two pieces of advice. The first one is you will encounter imposter syndrome.
Yes.
We were talking about that.
It happens all the time.
Imposter syndrome will wipe you out if you let it. And imposter syndrome, if you don't know what it is, it's basically the thought that goes in the back of your head that says, I didn't deserve where I got to be, my product is crap and people just aren't telling me that, or that someday someone's going to find out that you're you and you're going to get lynched by your supporters.
Right.
And that is...
You tricked them somehow.
That is the biggest lie that your brain will tell you, is that somehow you tricked your way into getting where you're in. It's not true.
Quick digression on how insidious this is. A few weeks ago, I was... part of a group of consultants for iThrive Games, actually, that does also some more work as Banana Group. And so we're going in a room talking about ourselves, talking about imposter syndrome. And one of the women there, she's been working in tabletop role-playing games since 1975. She is a seminal artist, Janelle Jaque. She worked at ColecoVision when they first started making games. She worked on Halo, and she's going, dude, I don't feel like I belong here. It's like, are you kidding me? But she even feels that.
Neil Gaiman. And I think it was Buzz Aldrin.
Yes.
Yeah. They were
Neil Armstrong.
Neil Armstrong, sorry. Neil Gaiman. Neil Gaiman is like one of the most prolific writers of our time. Mm-hmm. Neil Armstrong walked on the bloody moon. I mean,
maybe.
Whatever.
He was a pastor.
Oh my god. But they're basically in this big, boring field with like famous people, and they find each other in the corner. And Neil Gaiman is talking to Neil Armstrong saying, like, oh yeah, I don't think I belong here. And Neil Armstrong just like, yeah, I don't either. It was like, and these people that have done groundbreaking work.
National hero.
Right. Like someone who has set the pace for a lot of writers that have come after them and inspirations to, I'm fairly sure I say all of us.
Yeah.
Some way we've all read Neil Gaiman stuff.
Absolutely. He's all right.
Yeah. He's all right. He's all right.
American Gods is fantastic.
But yeah, it's like, Spawn TV series, man. Those people didn't think they were good enough to be around their peers. And they are their peers. Like these are, it's the biggest lie your brain will tell you. Don't listen to it. Just if you've got community, you've got people liking your game. Even if it's just one or two people liking your game, thrive in that. Like you've created something. It's yours. Make sure that you own it. And then the other thing.
Can I jump in on the imposter?
Yeah, sure. Go.
So when I was struggling with this in therapy, my therapist said, the voice that tells you all these bad things about yourself. What does it sound like? Sounds like my voice. He said, okay, there's the first mistake. Give it a voice and give it a name. I said, okay, Doug and my voice. He said, no. So now my imposter syndrome is named Stamford. And all of his sentences begin with, well, actually, no one likes you. And game is only successful because John Gilmore is a big name, and the next
thing you Stanford.
Right. I don't need this right now, Stanford.
That's amazing.
So
I love
good.
That. Yeah.
When's that game coming out? That's what I want to know.
Shut up, Stanford.
I'll buy it. That's a good game.
Can I get your therapist number?
Yes.
That's so good.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah, you'd be surprised. I don't suffer for myself because I'm kind of a jerk.
So
many of the creative people, like we could have a round table of just the people who work for Onyx Band who all feel imposter syndrome. a lot of the time.
Which is crazy.
Yeah, it's like this amazingly scary uphill climb people have to make just to feel good about the thing they're creating. You should be amazed that you're making these things.
On the note of shut up Stanford, I think we're good.
Shut up Stanford.
Sorry, we had a second one.
The only other thing that I would say is when you're developing your game, if you're considering Kickstarter, make sure that you get as far along in development
as you can.
Because I didn't, and I'm suffering for it.
Also, so. Kickstarter is sort of the voice of the imposter syndrome, all yelling at you from different...
Yeah. Yes. But the thing is, I went into my first Kickstarter, and I expected to fail. Because like a lot of people's first time Kickstarters do fail. You need to go back and regroup and then come back with another pitch. My past first time, and which is incredibly lucky, and I had a really great supporting community, and still in the back of my head it's like, nah, this is a dream of bullshit. You don't deserve to have this many people backing you, it's ridiculous. But
yes,
they like
yes,
it.
You do.
But I do. Shut up, Stanford!
There you go.
No,
it's a shut up Stanford.
Shut up Stanford.
Now, is he allowed to take your Stanford? Like, is this just a general jerk that's running around?
I love the name Stanford. Stanford.
Do you mind if I take that?
Do it. Please, if it helps you, do it.
Yeah.
Stanford can be like the universal little
imposter syndrome.
We gotta find that guy and shut him up.
If there is any
support gamer in Stanford online,
any piece of advice you can take away from today is shut up Stanford.
If you want to do it. Or to be a nice best friend, but it's sort of
So any last questions or anything?
I wanted to kind of jump in on the therapist thing.
Yeah.
So my work I look at as, you know, happening in the area of disability. There was a guy who I talked about impairments. Impairment is something that is an actual limitation.
Yep.
Disability is something that's, for the most part, created by society or culture. Think about not being able to walk, that's an impairment, but if there's ramps and wheelchairs and elevators, it's not as much of a disability. So you guys talked about safety and talked a little bit about accessibility. For me, when I'm working with a group of kids who are defined by typically pathology or impairment, I'm looking at ways to encourage and empower them to be able to define themselves, to see themselves as heroes. Joseph Campbell, The Hero's Journey. I was wondering if in game design, how that comes up, what you guys think about or do with that.
Oh my God, I could spend an hour talking about disability and game design. Because I do it very much myself. But to keep it short, because we're running low on time.
Yeah, I can control
down. Oh, yeah, absolutely. We'll talk, don't worry. You're local to me, too. One of the things that I've had to work my way around is exactly that thing you talk about. A lot of early game design categorized those specifically as disadvantages and often gave points to buy the actual cool stuff you want to buy. It's like, well, you have hearing loss, but you use that offset to buy ninja skills. And it's like, so I'm a deaf ninja because the deaf is the way to get me to ninja. And so a lot of disability in those designs feel like it is an inconvenience to everyone, including the player. Which really, really hurts someone who's actually disabled. And so changing that into where it's just a thing. One of the things that, specifically I'm working on a supplement called Pirates of Pugmire, and one of the things that Regina talked about actually was that pirates have a lot of disability, or to use your terminology, a lot of impairments. Missing hands, missing legs, missing eyes. And so the first thing I was like, don't do too much of that, because I don't want to feel like there's a disproportionate amount. If suddenly you get into a boat and you lose all of your limbs, you know, I don't want it to make sure it's clear that this is not as much of a thing as pop culture makes it seem to be. But separately, also, I plan to have a small section that just says, if you want this to be important to your game, make it. If not, you're the badass dog that happens to have an eye patch, you know, or your badass dog that happens to have a hook for a hand. That's cool. Rawr, you know, if it's cool, then it's cool. If it's something you want to play through, then you opt into that disability. So the impairment can become a disability if the players all agree to that. That is a design shift. It's just making sure the mechanics don't give disproportionate weight to impairments.
So in the superhero game I wrote, you have like hindrances, but you know, I use Daredevil's blindness. Like, he's blind, but how often is it really an issue? And the hindrances, you know, you can define them however you want, and they're usually player activated. And what it does is it gives you, you know, sort of like karma points ostensibly right. that you can use later. So if you don't ever want to activate, that's fine. You know, and you are all considered to be capable across the board. If you want your blindness to be a factor, it's a factor. In RetroStar, which you played, you know, even your negative traits have a thing that you can use for a positive. Because in those shows, like, if you're like, I'm weak, like, that's used and and yes, you can't necessarily do the things, but every once in a while you can. So, you know, you can turn it around and make it into, you know, not a positive, like, everyone wants to do this thing, but what is it narratively? Do you know what I mean? Like, exactly. My games aren't about, like, you need to be able to do this thing. My games are about, do whatever you want to do. Like, you know, that's working.
From your experience with the kids, do you think they would feel they would be more engaged with a scenario like where you could surpass, say you're a blind person, and in the game it enables you to be blind, but also to get Daredevil's radar senses. Is that a better place to be for them, or is the idea that there's nothing wrong with being blind, you don't need anything special to go with that, you'll be okay, it's fine. What works best?
One of the things about mental health, about therapy, is the answer is...
There's no...
It depends.
Yep. Yeah.
On who and what it is. And a lot of times, you know, when there is an impairment or a disability, the superpower is the opposite of that, or you recover from that or because mm-hmm. of that loss. It's really more... I think, can be empowering for kids who are defined by the deficit
yep.
to see that, you know, okay, maybe just looking at this thing in a different light. But there was something I talked about earlier yep. about, and I heard you talk about this too on the Onyx podcast, but there's something in the Kids on Mics book talks about if you want to play a character who has autism, then that comes with, you know, there may be this kind of challenge that arises.
Right.
And there's also this kind of strength that arises.
Yep.
And it's just shifting that from an idea of pathology to, no, you define yourself.
Okay, so,
do you yeah. want that to be a part of your character? Do you not want that to be a part of your character? You know, some people are not ready to play that. Some people are. But give them that opportunity. Middle school kids, and one of them started the game, he wanted to be a parrot. Okay. Mm-hmm. And then we got to a point in the game, and there was something he wanted to do, but he couldn't do because he was a parrot. He's like, I don't want to be a parrot anymore. All right, guys, what do you think? Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, that's fine. So, you know, being able to change and adapt the story and talk about homebrew and house rule and adjusting.
You break the parrot curse.
Yeah. Yes.
You're a prince all along.
Yeah. That's good.
So, yeah, just... I want kids to be able to see themselves as a hero. And
yeah.
if the hero is blind, that's awesome.
Right.
And so the section in Kids on Bikes came out of, we put the draft set of the rules out for feedback, and somebody who's John is friends with on Facebook wrote in and say, I'd really love to play this. I'd want to make a character who was like me when I was in middle school. We said, great, you can do that. And he said, no, I can't. He said, you don't have any, there's nothing in there about what to do about somebody with a degenerative neurologic disease. We said, okay.
You are correct.
Right. And so, you know, we worked on that, and we went very much into the, in the first draft of it, you know, very much into the duality of it. You have this, yeah. you have this impairment, but that comes with this strength. And we showed it to him, and he said, how's everybody with language in here?
Earmuffs.
Yeah.
He said, it's a nice sentiment, but it's bullshit. Like, there's nothing good about my neurological right. degenerative disease that's going to kill me in the next 10 years.
Right.
It sucks. I mean, have I adapted to it, and are there things that I'm better at now? Sure, but it's not one for one. And so then we put more language in that said, but hey, like, sometimes... You might choose a character who has something that is...
Doesn't have an upside.
Right. Doesn't have an upside.
Yep.
Yeah.
You know, you're not... Someone who is wheelchair bound is not able to walk on so strong with their upper body that they'll win every arm wrestling competition or walk on their hands.
No.
Like
that starts getting to dysphoria erasure.
Right. Right.
Yeah. And there's an entire panel we could do on just that piece. I found, especially in the hearing loss community, there are people who are extremely embarrassed by it, and so therefore they find value in the erasure. And it's like, I want to play a character who has hearing, and I don't feel like this way. And there are other parts of the culture that are very proud, particularly the deaf side. The deaf culture is a very strong thing. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, it's not my fault you can't speak my language. You know, the fact that you don't know how to work around me isn't my problem. And there's some strength and value that comes from that as well. I kind of go back and forth between the two poles, as it were, depending on what day it is. But I mean,
there's,
you know,
so similarities with autism community.
Yeah,
too.
And certain people are like, well, I'm autistic, just cope with it, you know, and that they find value in that. By allowing the game, as long as like this is a good point, it's like by having game flexibility, because like with the autism thing, you could probably easily zero in if someone really wants to kind of have that upside, you kind of just, okay, cool, then just I'm just gonna lean into that. That it's a balance, and some people who really want to say, no, there's nothing good about it, and they can drop that off. So giving them options to get that experience they want, particularly from that kind of minority, is very, very powerful.
Brief answer to that for me is that there's no easy answer.
Yeah.
There's no way to be able to cater to everything. And that's not from a place of, well, it's not my problem. It's from a place of that if I try, I will fail. Like you
sometimes it's not your story to tell.
Yeah, it's you know, there's the better thing you can do is empower those gamers to make systems that they feel comfortable with themselves. Allow them to build their own homebrew. Allow them to change rules that makes them feel more comfortable. Like it's this you can do for your players. Your players are, from a design standpoint, they're your lifeblood. You know, I am beholden to my backers and the people who are part of my community that are helping keep me going forward. If I came across some way that I could help them, then I would try and do that. But proactively trying to go ahead and say, I'm going to be inclusive of every disability or every limitation or every impairment that I can possibly think of,
it's an exhaustive list.
It's a hugely exhaustive list, and I don't want to say it's impossible, because I'm hoping, I honest to God hope that someone out there can come up with a system that does include everything, and then we can all play it, and it'll be fantastic. I hope that there's some way of doing it. I just know that it's not within my capability. I can just make the people that come to me directly more comfortable.
Right. And I think there's a difference between being inclusive and not being exclusive.
Right.
Yeah. If you design so that you don't cut people out, but that's at least part of the way forward.
My thanks card. It's like, here, this guy.
Yeah, perfect.
Everybody's in. It's an issue. That's a concern, and let's make that part.
If everybody's in.
Yeah.
I was just reading someone who was saying that the X card freaks them out, that they can't play any games with the X card because it, the way that it's being played now, where you simply go, that never happened, is too close to the abuse that they suffered, because they were told what happened to them didn't happen.
I didn't think about that. It's basic gaslighting.
Of course.
An
example of the whole game.
It's a good example of something that is what seems intrinsically to us as an amazing thing suddenly becomes a really horrific trigger for someone. And that is, when building these systems, it's really, really difficult to be inclusive or to be across the board. You just have to read your crowd. It's like any kind of art. Any kind of art, you have to know your crowd, and you have to do what you can to make them. But again, you can't go into it with the brain set of like, yeah, I'm gonna make this.
I'm gonna solve racism. I'm gonna interject.
We should get to it.
And I'm gonna pause this conversation because I don't want it to end. But it's after 4.
Okay.
Right. So it's at 4:30.
I just.
All right. Thank you all very much.
Thank you guys.
Yeah. Thanks for coming.
And we're back. And
yay!
Normally this is the part where we have fun banter about the thing you just listened to, but it's an emergency episode, so no one except for me listened to it. So
I am sure it was fantastic. The best yet.
I think you made some amazing points somewhere around minute 37. I have no idea.
That is
rich though. couldn't stand everything he said. I couldn't disagree more.
To be fair,
don't
you got
say that.
That's actually a pretty accurate breakdown of what happened. We love you, Rich. Please don't
we
stop paying
Rich.
Us. So instead of the usual bantery goodness, we're going to banter in a different way. Many, many moons ago, we did ask people to send questions to us that they wanted to have answered, and so we've compiled a bunch of them together to kind of go through them all. It's kind of a mini Q&A episode, and if you guys like this, feel free to leave more questions on the blog posts so we can maybe do a full Q&A episode at some point, potentially when we have another emergency.
Yeah.
So I'm going to start with somebody that you got on the podcast stream. These are from Aceblade44. And three questions, two of which, actually I'll go through all of them because it's mostly for you and Matthew and Dixie. First one is, so for Mummy, their theme of timelessness, from what I think I heard, instead of the linear progression they normally have, they are now kind of outside time, with them appearing through multiple eras one after another, but not in a linear fashion. Does this mean Sothic turns are still a thing?
Shall I take this one?
Go for it.
I will. So, yes, Sothic turns are still a thing in Mummy the Curse 2nd Edition. The thing to remember with the times when Sothis ascends, those are the very rare occasions where all mummies awaken, arise at the same time. Now, the main issue we have with the Sothic turn with 2nd Edition is because of the way it was staggered in 1st Edition, we've passed the Sothic turn, and now it's going to be around 1,456 years until the next one. So it doesn't really make much sense for it to be the focus of 2nd Edition as it was in the 1st Edition. The 1st Edition was very much set around the 4th Sothic turn, and that's the number from memory. So yes, they have still definitely happened, and you can certainly still move back to a previous Sothic turn because of the timeless nature of Mummy 2nd Ed, but there isn't going to be an upcoming one in the near future, that's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, and if you want to wait for the next one, you'd be playing, like, you know, Cyber Mummy 3450.
Which is an expansion we desperately need. So, you know, if Mummy 2 is on Kickstarter, I don't know for certain that it will be. I mean, I hope it is, because of the other Chronicles of Darkness games we've put on there. If it is, by all means, bang your drum, post in the comments, we want cyber mummies, and watch Rich's head explode.
Oh no, what have I done?
This is revenge for Cyberpunk 3030.
I mean, I did that one too. And also Porgmire, which would get us sued.
Right. So in retrospect, revenge is probably the wrong word.
Yeah, no, this is just me building on my terrible ideas that we'll never be allowed to do.
What about Cyber Vampire? Actually, speaking of
that's
vampires.
That's possible. Yeah.
One of the other questions we had from Iceblade 44 is that they were quite excited about the elaboration on the relationship between vampires and the Arisen. I find it very interesting that while the idea of a vampire cultist is cool, compared to Mummy, they are more individualistic and self-centered than mummies in that regard. So they were interested in seeing what if there's any more about the dynamic between a mummy who naturally gets that power and influence because of who they are and a vampire who has survived the Danse Macabre to be the vampire they are tonight.
Is this a Dixie or a Matthew one?
Either one. You guys are both working on the book. So.
I mean, that's the mummy vampire kind of crossover question. I haven't played with that too much yet since it's still in writing.
It's an interesting one because we will have a section of the antagonists chapter, which is going to be a hefty chapter of Mummy the Curse, dedicated to what mummies might deem as false immortals. So you will have your lifeless Shranksen, you'll have your blood bathers, you'll have your various and sundry antagonists that might appear in Mummy. Vampires will appear in there in some form or other. We need to really decide how much of the focus they receive. I think you're right, George, you're right. Let's get your name right. David, there you go. Shut up. We don't do this. These caller questions often. Give me some rope with which to hang myself, please. The question of how much focus vampires get is something we need to weigh up, because obviously with the rules as presented in Vampire the Requiem, they're quite nuanced, as all the protagonist creatures are in Chronicles of Darkness, and we don't want to present a pared down version of vampire. But likewise, if we expect readers of Mummy the Curse to own Vampire the Requiem 2nd Edition, which they probably do, but if we expect it in order for you to get the fullness out of whatever we've written for 2nd Ed, it may be an expectation too far.
Yeah.
So,
Sorry,
over to you.
Okay, I will say that in most 2nd Edition core books, our tendency, if we refer to some of the other, you know, splats from other lines, is to do it in a more, you know, kind of a subtler manner, and then save it for like a Night Horrors book to actually flesh it out and say, like, okay, here's what, you know, a Deva vampire would do to a mummy, etc. Yeah, so that's kind of where we usually fall on it.
Now, I'll give an unofficial response here, though, by all means, because we're looking at the idea of mummies being able to invest their pillars in their cultists. So a mortal cultist can wield very low level powers, then you've got sorcerer cultists, then you have other immortals, then you might have a Sadiq, the lineup there might change. The vampires would fall within that immortal bracket, so the upper end of mummy channelers. So theoretically, a mummy could invest some of its power in a vampire, and that would make for an incredibly powerful vampire. But would it still be a vampire as we know it from Requiem, or something completely different? That's for our writers and us to discuss and see whether we've got the space to actually flesh it out. Or, as Dixie says, it may be something fit for a Night Horrors book or even a Dark Eras book.
Right.
And actually, that's a nice segue, because speaking of Night Horrors books, one of the last questions we had from Iceblade 44 for you, Dixie, he was asking more about Spilled Blood. We announced that it would be a Night Horror book for Requiem, and they were wondering, what is focusing on this different from the previous two Night Horror books for Requiem?
Yeah, well, I don't have a ton of information on this, only because it's not a project that was started when I was doing this job, so I haven't been privy to all the pitches and everything. That said, I know it's supposed to be a pretty good mix of some vampire antagonists, some non-vampire things that antagonize vampires, Bloodlines, Lost Clans. I think that Danielle in her blog post said weird non-vampire vampire things. Ooh. So that could be all kinds of stuff. And then some antagonistic covenants. It is, however, going to give a pretty good version of an updated Belial's Brood, which I know was very, very popular before. So that's like, you know, vampire, just really, really bad guys and cultists and Satanist type characters and things. Not that all Satanists are bad. I know that Satanism is an actual religion.
Right.
So we're going to update Belial's Brood a little bit to 2E with this product. So awesome. It should be fun.
Yeah, sounds really exciting.
I think keep an eye on the blog for that too, because I do believe that Danielle, who is the dev on that, is doing an update for it soon.
There we go.
So that should be on the blog, you know, the next few weeks here, I'd say. I don't control when blog posts go up, but yeah.
Fair enough. And then finally, George Lemke had a couple of questions that are primarily in my wheelhouse, but throw them out there anyway. Ask them to myself.
Interview yourself.
Treat yourself.
Because we won't do it.
Right.
Yeah. I'll do a full disclosure podcast right now. If there are any weird sounds or if my voice gets weird, it's because my cat will not leave me alone. And he has pulled my headphone cord out once while Matthew was talking, so I missed like half an answer. It's been great.
See, she's challenging you to a duel. That's what the higher...
He really is.
Poor anyway. Apollo just doesn't like me.
How did you know it was Apollo? Oh, right, because it's always Apollo.
Because it's always Apollo.
Always Apollo. All 14 pounds of Apollo.
In the revised or reimagined Battlestar Galactica, Leah Dama was a bit of a whiny prick.
Apollo was named after the sun god, so...
Unfortunately for me... Battlestar has trumped Mount Olympus. So frankly, I'm very disappointed that Scion doesn't have more references to Battlestar Galactica in it.
And we're back to not being sued again.
Anyway, Eddie, ask yourself some questions.
Porgmire. So, George Lemke...
Porgmire.
asked us if we were going to do a deep dive about the Story Path system in particular, as opposed to the games that use Story Path. And I think that's definitely something we can do. There's a lot of things that the Story Path system is doing that's new and cool and interesting, and also it's a chance to kind of talk about people who are familiar with storytelling and storyteller, what they expect change-wise, what they expect to stay the same. So yeah, I think we can all do a deep dive on that. And we've all worked on or looked at or read Story Path games, so I think we're all going to talk about that on some level.
I've read the rules 6 times.
Yeah, you're very familiar with them.
I have forgotten all of them. Okay, it's okay.
That's fine.
I vaguely know them. I
You literally designed a game that uses that system.
It's true, but when I wrote They Came From, well, developed They Came From, I didn't write the whole damn thing, as you'll see from the author list. That was, that. I think Story Path has been through a couple of revisions since, well, your draft, Eddie.
Yeah.
So, at time of recording, They Came From is actually, it's been edited,
mm-hmm.
It's been post-edit developed, if that's the right way of putting it,
yep.
Probably not. And now it's back over to Eddie just to make sure the system all hangs together.
Right.
So that's a very exciting thing.
We made a couple of small tweaks. And I think most stuff we tweaked was stuff we ditched for They Came From anyway. So
wonderful.
And then one more of a trend of comments, I will say. And this goes back to Revenge/Blaming Dixie. I've had a lot of people talk about their opinions of Birds with Hands. I have seen so many pictures of Birds with Arms, Birds with Hands, Velociraptor pictures, just there's an unending stream of bird pictures, which have all been very, very, let's say useful, been very informative to help me to kind of finalize things and figure out where that wants to go. So thank you all so much for your Birds with Arms pictures.
You don't sound at all sarcastic right now, Eddie, at all.
Yeah, what I hope is it helps leaven the sheer number of posts and photos you get tagged in that relate to pugs presented in a comedic or cute fashion. You know, for every 5 pugs, you'll get a bird with hands.
That's about right, although there was a couple of disproportionate bursts of pug sharing, like when something particularly exciting is. And also, I get cycles. Like, I think I'm on the 4th cycle of the Lord of the Rings pugs. It's like, you know, oh, someone shared it. So now everyone shared it with Eddie. It's like, yes, I saw it. It was one of the original inspirational images for Pugmire several years ago. But, I mean, I can't really complain too much about people putting cute and funny animals into my feed on a regular basis. So at the end of the day, it's not really a bad thing. It could be worse.
I'm looking forward to that inception moment, or the point at which the dragon swallows its tail and something is shared with you that you created. So, hey, look at this fantastic art that would look wonderful in Pugmire. It's already in Pugmire.
Right.
That would be hilarious. Also, I think next time I see a pug, I'm going to show them a picture of you, Eddie. Like, next time I'm walking around in real life and I see a pug, I'm just going to be like, get out my phone, pull up your Facebook profile, and be like, look, it's Eddie. Eddie made a game about you.
I would love that.
And then someone can take a picture of me doing that, and then we'll share that to your wall. But it'll be original content.
That'll be
depending
amazing.
On the pug, it will ignore it, eat it, dribble on it.
Oh my god, Apollo
turn
is standing
it into
right
a
next.
Nest.
Apollo is now trying to eat my microphone. Apollo, this is the least helpful you've ever been.
We should put Apollo on the podcast.
We already have him on the podcast right now. Anyway,
so what comments have you guys found?
I found one from, I don't know how he pronounces his username, but it's Yodan, Yiodan. Also, I probably shouldn't gender this person because I don't know them. Yes. It is from Yodan. They asked about our like our dream games, which I think once again, kind of like the story pass system, might be a whole episode unto itself.
Yeah.
But you know, no restrictions as far as licensing, money, you know, system, book size, whatever. What properties would we turn into a game, or what kind of games would we make? And I think that would be an awesome, like, you know, hour and a half long of us just chatting about things that we think would be fun to turn into games. So we should probably hold on to that one.
Yeah, totally.
But a lot of the things that always pop into my head immediately have already become games. Things like Buffy, mm-hmm. my, you know, favorite TV show of all time. There was a Sailor Moon game back in the 90s.
Yes, there was.
I'd love to see a remake of that or something like that. And then my favorite book series is something called Kushiel's Dart by Jacqueline mm-hmm. Carey. And I think that would make an awesome game just because it's a really rich land full of really cool lore. So those are my like big three probably.
Cool.
I would also say War for the Oaks, which I mentioned in our inspiration episode, but that's mm-hmm. pretty much already Changeling.
Fair.
Because it's just urban fantasy. Punk rock. Well, honestly, if we did a Changeling book set in the 80s, like New Wave Requiem, that would be War for the Oaks, and I would be so excited if we did that. So I'm gonna think about that now. I'm gonna go away and talk to Megan Fitzgerald. Bye.
New Wave.
What about you guys? Do you have anything that like jumps to your brains that we can talk about further in an episode?
Well, for me, I guess there's a few different avenues, and I suppose we're looking at external media that inspires us in a gaming fashion,
or just something that you think would be a really cool game. Like, it doesn't have to be a media property.
Well, if it's something I think would be a really cool game, I should probably pitch it to Rich, but we'll discuss it. In terms of other media, I was a big fan of the Metal Gear franchise before it got even more ridiculous. Mm. And drilling back down to its sort of original format of a sort of stealth espionage game where you... The initial concept of having, I guess, bosses with superpowers, each dynamically different in a very... antagonistic environment that appealed to me. I would love to be able to explore the world of Metal Gear in an RPG fully. BioShock as well. I mentioned in another podcast I went quite far with developing that myself. And in terms of novels, there's so many wonderful worlds that have been created.
I'm like staring at my bookshelf across the room right now, and I'm just like, that one, and that one, and that one.
Uh-huh. And I am doing the exact same thing. So, you know, there's part of me that would love to do a fully fledged, pure historical game, although I know it wouldn't sell.
Yeah.
I would love to do something that encompasses the 15th century in Britain, for instance, because I find it an incredibly interesting era.
Mm-hmm.
But going over to movies, there's some things like the Tarantino verse of films that I know. Obviously, Pulp Fiction is the name of one of his movies, but his movies are very pulpy in general. Or the Avengers, the TV series, not the Marvel property, but John Steed and Emma Peel.
Emma Peel, that'd be fun.
Emma Peel. But the every
I wasn't saying it like that, but. All right.
No, she was a childhood crush of mine, that's for sure. But I, the fantastic way that in every single episode of the Avengers, they had a brand new antagonist. It was always colourful, a brand new plot. There was absolutely no crossover from one episode to the next. It's perfect for modular play, in my opinion. But anyway, that's my ideas.
Eddie, do you have a couple?
I do, actually. One would probably be a shock to no one.
Is it Sherlock Holmes?
It is, in fact, Sherlock Holmes.
No one would play.
I've actually...
Nobody likes Sherlock Holmes.
...kicked a few ideas around, and I have and have had long rants about why Sherlock Holmes is extremely difficult to make into a game that checks all the appropriate license boxes. So it's definitely an ongoing struggle, debate. You know, I've got like several different half designs worked out, so it's definitely something I personally would want to work with. And some of it is, you know, form factor and other concerns besides, like, you know, money and stuff. A lot of limitations are not what you would expect from Dream Game, more along the lines of just, how do you solve this problem? Another one that I would probably commit minor crimes to be on is if a Transformers tabletop role-playing game.
Ah.
I actually have done I've done a few different systems for this unofficially as a fan created product. And in fact, one of my friends recently posted on his wall the game I version I did and ran for them back in 1999, which was a blast from the past. And I still have the old files from 18 years ago, and it even says, like, you know how, if you look in your folder for Windows, it says, you know, last time you updated, it's like, last updated 18 years ago. I'm just like, wow, that's terrifying in some ways. But I mean, also, there's some that's more obscure ones, like, I don't know if any of you are familiar with the Queen and Country comic.
Yeah, yeah.
That I think will be really good as a tabletop role-playing game, because it's very gritty spy, as opposed to the more kind of spy-fi or super spy things like the Avengers or James Bond. It's much more kind of gritty, realistic espionage, and I think that would make a really compelling role-playing, in particular with something like the Story Path system. And then just, like you said, I mean, I got to also look at my bookshelf and just keep naming off stuff. That would be cool. That would be
yeah,
cool.
Like, I could sit here and just rattle these off forever, which is why I'm thinking full episode, like, soon. Because that'll give me a chance to make a list and actually think about it, because there's so many things I'm staring at right now that I'm like, yep, that one, and that one, and that one.
We've already spent, like, 10 minutes on it, on the quick version of it, so.
Yeah, so, let's stop naming things on that for right now. Did we have any other questions?
I've just had a flash of inspiration, though. I want to mention it.
Oh, God, I've had, like, 8. So, what's this one? Why is it so special?
Well, so you've both played or are aware of Monster Hearts, aren't you?
Yeah.
A very simple relationship game, fantastic in its delivery. I was looking at my bookshelf. I've got the behind-the-scenes book on Oz, you know, the old HBO TV show set in prison. And setting a game of Monster Hearts, a Monster Hearts-esque game set in prison with the various gangs you could play, various roles you could play in prison, it would be quite a grimy game, I imagine. But that could be quite good fun as well.
Especially with the success of things like Orange is the New Black. I mean, there's lots of, you know, prison media that you could go off of to recreate something like that. So, yeah, no, that'd be kind of cool. Yeah.
So, Matthew, have you seen any questions floating around? Did you want to answer?
No, I did have a look through the rest of the blog, and sadly my question trawl was unsuccessful, so apologies to anyone listening who has asked a question and I've not addressed, but my suggestion to you, as Eddie said at the beginning of this outro, is leave comments for us. Leave them, ideally, on this blog post, the blog post that puts this podcast up and out to the world on Friday. Leave them here. We will capture them, we'll corral them, and we will address them in an episode dedicated to Q&A. Yeah.
And just to completely clarify, he means the blog at theonyxpath.com.
Yeah.
Not like on the Podbean stream or what have you. If we can get them there, but they're a little harder to view. And if we can collect them all on the blog post, that would be really awesome, because then we can just open that up and go through it or print it off or what have you.
And also it allows us to quickly comment on there if it's a topic for some reason we can't cover, like it's under NDA or just we don't have an answer for it. We just can say, hey, we can't really cover that. So that way you get an answer even if it's not going to be on this podcast.
Exactly.
And with that, we are getting close to the 2-hour mark. So our emergency episode is also our longest episode. Yay! So with that, thank you guys both for helping me out on this rush job. And to all of you at home, many worlds, one path games.